The Israeli Defense Force, Israel's well-funded and high-tech army, is the most moral army in the world. That is, if you believe the branding.
צה"ל הוא הצבא המוסרי ביותר בעולם.
The most moral army in the world.
IDF is a moral army.
The most moral.
The moralist.
The IDF does more to safeguard the rights of civilians than any other army in the history of warfare.
But apart from the allegations of war crimes in Gaza, the attempts to paint it as an animal-friendly, queer-friendly, religiously tolerant military institution, the history of the IDF says more about it than its social media image. Before the formation of the State of Israel in 1948, and before there was an Israeli army, there were three underground Zionist militias: the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Lehi. They were comprised of mainly Jewish migrants to the British Mandate of Palestine, with the aim of helping usher in the Jewish state by any means necessary. They differed in their tactics and beliefs, and at times fought with each other, but together they terrorized Palestinian villages, committed acts of violence, terrorism, and ethnic cleansing, and executed bombings and assassinations against the British to force them to give up control of the land. They blew up hotels in Jerusalem, embassies in Europe, and assassinated a UN mediator. All of this happened before 1948, because after Israel was officiated as a state, these three groups would be brought together to create the IDF, and their militia leaders would go on to form Israel's government, become politicians, ambassadors, and prime ministers. And their dark history would be forgotten. So, let's talk about it. Let's begin at the turn of the 20th century. Europe was embroiled in revolution, war, and great social upheaval. Anti-Semitism had been rife for centuries in Europe, but attacks against Jewish communities had become widespread, particularly in Russia. While most attempted to flee to the United States, around 30,000 Russian Jews migrated to Palestine from 1882 to 1904, then under the rule of the Ottoman Empire. These communities were known as the New Yeshuv, and they built small self-reliant settlements independent of the old Yeshuv, who consisted mostly of Arab Jews who'd migrated to Jerusalem over centuries, mostly for religious practice. Unlike the old Yeshuv, the new Yeshuv were driven by a new ideology that was growing popular among European Jews as well as some influential Christian figures: Zionism.
And the basis of Zionism was the belief that the Jewish question, as it was called, in Europe, in other words, the place of Jews, given the rising anti-Semitism, could only be solved territorially, that is, by establishing a state of their own. And from very early on, that state had to be in Palestine, because that way you could use religious legitimacy to justify what was settler colonialism.
The new Yeshuv were ambitious. They built farms, formed trade unions and councils to purchase land from Palestinians. They also began to form small militias, seeking to replace hired Arab watchmen with Jewish guards to protect the new outposts. Some of these militias, like Bar Giora, had bigger plans. Its members wanted to create the beginnings of an underground army, one that would one day serve a future Jewish state, and fight for one if need be. One of its founders was a young Polish laborer called David Grun, who migrated to Palestine in 1906. He was shocked at how many Palestinian Arabs worked in the new settler colonies as farmers and guards, and set about trying to build connections between migrants and fundraise to ensure the Yeshuv would become completely self-reliant. This included more money to buy weapons. Like many other Jewish migrants, he later adopted a Hebrew last name and would hence be known as David Ben-Gurion. We'll come back to him. By 1909, militias like Bar Giora began to evolve into larger networks, the most prominent being Hashomer, or the Watchman. Despite only having a few dozen members, Hashomer began to think of itself as guarding not only the colonies and property set up by the new Yeshuv, but as a vigilante force that would respond to disputes. If a Jewish person was attacked by a Palestinian, Hashomer would send its armed members to seek revenge. They were inspired by Ukrainian Cossacks and, interestingly, Palestinian Bedouins. They rode on horseback and even dressed in kufiyas. Weird, right? In his book Orientalism and the Hebrew Imagination, Historian Yaron Peleg says the young Zionists wanted to recreate the image of the Jewish man and reject the anti-Semitic tropes of Jews as weak and passive. In the new Yeshuv, they focused on farming and fighting as ways to build stronger, more self-reliant men, what Zionist leader Max Nordau described as muscular Judaism. And while they drew inspiration from the agricultural Arabs they saw around them, they no longer wanted to rely on Palestinian laborers and guards in their settlements. The Jewish state of the future had to rely on a Jewish workforce, and eventually, a Jewish army. At this point, the total Jewish population of Palestine was around 60,000, and accounted for only about 7% of the population, with many of the earlier Russian migrants going back home once the situation had eased. But by the end of World War I, everything had changed. The Ottoman Empire collapsed, and Palestine was taken over by the British Army. Lord Arthur Balfour, himself a Christian Zionist and foreign secretary, signed the Balfour Declaration, promising to create a Jewish state in mandatory Palestine. This led to a bigger wave of migration to the new Yeshuv, and up to 100,000 Jewish migrants arrived from Eastern Europe in the decade following the war. By now, the local Palestinian Arab population were starting to feel like something was amiss, were outraged at the Balfour Declaration, and many of them saw it as a European plot to colonize Arab land. House purchases in Jerusalem and Hebron were increasing, as were the construction of Jewish kibbutzes and settlements. But what pushed tensions to the brink was the increased religious activity around the Western Wall and Al-Aqsa compound, which some radical voices were arguing should be under total Jewish control. This spilled over into riots and general strikes targeting British and Jewish outposts, which escalated into communal fighting in 1920 and 1921. But the Zionist leaders, it proved that the local paramilitary groups needed to be better organized and better equipped to protect the new Yeshuv. This led to the establishment of the Haganah, or the defense, which formed from the Hashomer recruits, as well as an influx of soldiers who had served in Jewish regiments in the British Army during World War I. They smuggled in more advanced weapons from abroad, and by the 1930s, the majority of Jewish settlers were enlisted, and the paramilitary group became the foundation of the new Yeshuv. The Haganah now resembled what the Bar Giora had once dreamt up, an underground army fighting for the promise of a Jewish state. Initially, they coordinated and at times fought alongside the British against Palestinian Arab rioters and small skirmishes. The worst of these happened in 1929, when a rumor spread to Hebron that two Palestinians had been killed in the holy city of Jerusalem, and that a plot was underway to take Al-Aqsa. A riot ensued, targeting Jewish homes and synagogues. There were only 700 Jews in Hebron at the time, and many were sheltered by Palestinian families until the fighting ended, but by that time at least 50 Jewish settlers had been killed. The militants began to feel that the small British military presence was reluctant to fight the Palestinians, and resentment began to grow within their ranks. Some still looked to the British for protection, but others saw them as merely an obstacle to statehood that needed to move out of the way by force if necessary. Remember David Ben-Gurion? He'd now become the de facto leader of the new Yeshuv as the president of the Jewish Agency, working with the British to protect Jewish interests and to shut down calls for unity with Palestinians. But Ben-Gurion didn't want to confront the Arabs head-on, not at this stage at least. He also didn't want to create problems with his British allies and instituted a policy of havlaga, restrained. Under his watch, the Haganah forces would only be deployed to protect Jewish settlements, not launch offenses against Palestinian villages. At least, not for another few years. In a letter he would later write to his son in 1937, Ben-Gurion made his intentions pretty clear. Quote, "We must expel the Arabs and take their places. And if we have to use force, not to dispossess the Arabs of the Negev and the Transjordan, but to guarantee our own right to settle in those places, then we have force at our disposal." Ben-Gurion's focus was back on Europe, where the tides of anti-Semitism were rising to unprecedented levels. With the emergence of Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich, it became clear that more efforts were needed to transfer as many Jews to Palestine as possible. Over the next decade, a quarter of a million European Jews would flee to Palestine, pushing existing tensions to a boiling point. The divisions within the Haganah were growing as well, between those who followed Ben-Gurion's lead and another group of revisionist Zionists, who not only felt that the British were getting in the way of the dream of creating a greater Israel over the whole of the Mandate of Palestine, but who also believed that this greater Israel should extend to all of Jordan and parts of Lebanon and Syria. But to make this dream a reality, they needed to put an end to Palestinian resistance on their own terms, without waiting for orders from the British or even Ben-Gurion, whose policy of restraint failed to convince the most hardline young Zionists. So they took matters into their own hands, splintering from the Haganah and formed their own paramilitary group, the Irgun. The Irgun was led by a number of defected Haganah senior commanders, including, most significantly, the writer Ze'ev Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky was the founder of revisionist Zionism and had been active in Jewish defense efforts in the Russian Federation before going on to found one of the Jewish regiments in the British Army with the aim of fighting against the Ottomans in Palestine. In a paper he published in 1923 entitled The Iron Wall, Jabotinsky outlined his fundamental disagreements with Ben-Gurion and the other moderate Zionists, who he called vegetarians and peacemongers. Quote, "Our peacemongers are trying to persuade us that the Arabs are either fools, whom we can deceive by masking our real aims, or that they are corrupt and can be bribed to abandon to us their claim to priority in Palestine. We may tell them whatever we like about the innocence of our aims, watering them down and sweetening them with honeyed words to make them more palatable, but they know what we want." Jabotinsky believed that all native populations resist colonists, and that the only way to deal with them was by creating an iron wall of force that couldn't be penetrated. With his ideas, the new militia began to grow from dozens to thousands, with an emblem that represented their ambitions to expand to all of historic Palestine as well as Transjordan. They initially fought strategically alongside the Haganah and the British, but that would change in 1936, when a Palestinian uprising would push them to take matters into their own hands.
Unrest in Palestine. Suspecting that the Higher Committee had incited Arab leaders to start a holy war against the British government, police swooped on the secret headquarters of assassins and rebels. Many arrests were made.
It was called the Great Revolt. Furious at Britain's support for Zionism, the growing population of armed settlers, and the crippling economic impact of the Great Depression, the Palestinians attempted to overthrow British occupation, and with it, end the attempts of dividing their land. It began with a series of general strikes from mostly farmers, but soon the rebellion began to take structure, with armed rebels forming platoons and appointing leaders. But they were up against two British regiments, making up around 20,000 soldiers, as well as an armed and trained Jewish guard force and Haganah and Irgun forces that together made up tens of thousands of armed militiamen. In short, they were outnumbered and certainly outgunned. The uprising lasted for 3 years, ultimately failed, with British forces, the Haganah and Irgun, often fighting alongside each other to crush the Arab revolt, killing thousands and razing entire villages. Irgun militants planted explosives and landmines in public spaces and engaged in shootouts with Arab guards. Seeing the situation spiraling out of its control, and with another war brewing in Europe, Britain passed the White Paper in 1939, which implemented for the first time strict limits on Jewish migration, allowing for only 75,000 new migrants over 5 years. This was the final straw for Jabotinsky and the revisionists. They saw it as a betrayal, proof that the best way to protect Jewish interests in Palestine was to go on the offensive, and that their biggest threat wasn't the Palestinians, it was the British, who they now regarded as an occupying force that needed to be expelled. By this time, Jabotinsky himself had been exiled back to Europe by the British, who were concerned about his growing influence. There he began to formulate a plan, recruiting and training small underground cells in Poland that would first help evacuate as many as 1.5 million European Jews and sneak them and himself into Palestine illegally, bypassing the White Paper's restrictions. Together with one of the Irgun's leaders back in Palestine, a Polish Zionist named Avraham Stern, they recruited 40,000 Jewish militants and began smuggling handguns, rifles, explosives, and ammunition with the intention of launching their own revolt against the British. Stern even penned an anthem for the Irgun called Unknown Soldiers, a song that called on Jews to join the underground militias and die for their cause. But the outbreak of World War II would put the Irgun's plans of a great Jewish revolt on hold. Seeing the rise of Hitler and the systemic persecution of Jews in Poland, Germany, and later France, Jabotinsky offered to lend the British his trained Jewish militants to fight against the Nazis, the same way he'd done during World War I. A year later, he died of a heart attack while visiting a training camp in New York. But that decision to assist the British in the war would divide the Irgun and its remaining leaders, who were now in British detention camps. Over what direction to take the militia? Abraham Stern decided to split from the group and form his own militia, the Lehi, or Stern Gang, and tried to raise funds by robbing British banks, which were almost never successful. Stern's ideas were even more radical than Jabotinsky's. He advocated for the expulsion or complete annihilation of Palestinians, describing Jews as a master race and Arabs as a slave race. He and his group of small but fervent followers referred to themselves as terrorists, who believed that acts of terror were justified to reach their aims. Stern was so obsessed with fighting the British that in 1941, he wrote to Nazi authorities, pledging to fight alongside Hitler against the British if he agreed to help establish a Jewish state in Palestine.
He wanted to fight the British in order to gain independence. Stern, in his utter naivety, believed he could form an alliance with Hitler against the British.
He wanted to make an agreement with the Nazis so that the Nazis will send or let the Jews from Europe come here to Israel and be safe. And in addition, the Lehi will help the Germans by fighting the British.
But the Nazis never wrote back. Eventually, Stern was killed while attempting to flee an arrest warrant by British police. And while his group never gained the dominance he wished, it would continue to wield a significant impact on the events over the next few years. Meanwhile, as the horrors of World War II unfolded, David Ben-Gurion became engaged in the efforts to continue the illegal immigration of Jewish refugees to Palestine. Taking advantage of a distracted Britain, he employed the Haganah to organize a continuous fleet of vessels across the Mediterranean to sneak in thousands to the new Yishuv communities. By this point, there were close to 450,000 Jewish migrants in Palestine, though the British continued to restrict further official avenues for migration. And as the realities of the extent of the Holocaust were coming into light, the Zionists and the Irgun, who'd put aside their differences to fight alongside the British, were outraged and determined to take control of Palestine once and for all. By 1944, a young, devout follower of Zeev Jabotinsky had taken control of the militia. His name was Menachem Begin, and in 1944 declared an open rebellion against the British mandate, orchestrating a series of bombings on immigration offices in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Haifa. He then went after the tax offices, then the police stations. The Lehi joined in, taking part in a series of increasingly brazen attacks on British police officers, which eventually led to the assassination of Britain's Minister of State for the Middle East. On the 6th of November, Walter Edward Guinness, also known as Lord Moyne, was shot by two Lehi operatives outside his home in Cairo. His death sent shockwaves throughout the region and put the Zionist fight for control of Palestine on the world stage. Lehi and Irgun accused Lord Moyne of being one of the architects of the White Paper and used his death to send a message to Winston Churchill. One of Lehi's leaders and the brains behind the assassination, Yitzhak Shamir, later explained this in an interview.
He was against any Jewish aliyah, any Jewish immigration. He didn't believe that there exists such a thing like a Jewish nation or a Jewish people, and therefore, we decided to make this operation.
It would not be Shamir's last assassination. Britain, still embroiled in the war, leaned on Ben-Gurion and Zionist leaders to quell the attacks, and the Haganah began going after Irgun and Lehi members, killing or detaining thousands of them in a period that would later be referred to as the hunting season. Fearing an outbreak of civil war, Menachem Begin instructed his militants to stand down, knowing that their actions had proven popular among the Jewish population in the Yishuv, and his plan paid off. Within months, anger at the Haganah's continued collaboration with the British forced the Zionist leaders to back down and join forces with Begin and the Stern Gang to launch a united Jewish resistance movement. The alliance between the three paramilitary groups escalated the attacks against the British and began to target vital infrastructure around Palestine: railroads, bridges, prisons, and police stations. It was now widely believed among the Yishuv that the British had betrayed their promise of a Jewish state, and that immigration restrictions had to be overturned to accommodate for the large population of refugees fleeing the end of World War II. But the alliance had to remain secret to protect the standing of Zionist leaders in Europe, a secret that was exposed in 1946 during Operation Agatha, sometimes referred to as Black Sabbath. The British conducted sweeping raids of Jewish settlements, arresting thousands of Zionist activists and militants, and obtaining a trove of documents that proved the Jewish agency, including David Ben-Gurion and the Haganah, were now working with the Lehi and the Irgun, both of whom were considered terrorist organizations. The raid infuriated the militants and threatened the fragile alliance. In retaliation, Menachem Begin ordered the Irgun to carry out an operation on the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, which was the base of the British Secretariat and where the confiscated documents were kept. On July 22, 1946, Irgun operatives placed a 350-kilogram bomb in the basement of the hotel, blowing up its southern wing and killing 91 people. Of them, 41 were Palestinians, 28 were British citizens, and 17 were Jews. The shock of the attack forced the Haganah to retreat once again, and Britain escalated its crackdown on Zionist activists. But the Irgun and Lehi persisted with their operations, targeting British police in assassinations and kidnappings and branching out into Europe. 3 months later, they blew up the British embassy building in Italy. Then in January 1947, Lehi operatives drove a truck full of explosives into a British police station in Haifa. It was called the world's first truck bomb. Then in March of that year, they blew up a British colonial club in London. Weary from the aftermath of World War II and struggling to control fighting in most of its colonies, Britain appealed to the newly formed United Nations to find a solution to the situation in Palestine. The UN, then made up of only 57 member states, voted to divide the British mandate into three states, with 55% of the land allocated to Jews, who only made up a third of the population. The state outline for Jews itself had a big demographic problem. Half of its residents were Palestinian, who rejected the proposal and sought help from another new organization, the Arab League. The British, feeling like the situation was no longer their responsibility, announced they were ending their occupation of Palestine on the 15th of May, 1948.
I have been instructed by His Majesty's government to announce with all solemnity that they have consequently decided that in the absence of a settlement, they must plan for an early withdrawal of British forces and of the British administration from Palestine.
But this announcement only further escalated the tensions, and almost immediately, a civil war broke out between Palestinians and the Yishuv. By January 1948, an estimated 1,500 Palestinians and 400 Jews were killed in the fighting. Ben-Gurion, fearing a retaliation from the neighboring Arab states, began to reshape the Haganah from a paramilitary group into the beginnings of a structured army, implementing mandatory conscription for all Jewish men and women aged between 17 and 25. With the clock racing towards the 15th of May, Ben-Gurion and the Zionist leaders saw the war as an opportunity to cleanse the Palestinian population from the areas mapped out by the UN partition plan. On the 10th of March, they met in Tel Aviv and outlined Plan Dalet, a blueprint for targeting Palestinian population centers in the Jewish partition state and enacting a policy of forced depopulation and destruction. That plan was effectively already underway, but over the next few months, it would escalate into a campaign of terror and ethnic cleansing across Palestine. On the 5th of January 1948, Haganah soldiers blew up the Semiramis Hotel in Jerusalem, reportedly killing 26 Christian Palestinians as well as the Spanish vice consul. On the 14th of February, Haganah's special forces, the Palmach, attacked the northern Palestinian village of Sa'sa in the middle of the night, blowing up 16 houses and killing 60 villagers. On April 9th, Irgun and Lehi militants jointly committed the infamous Deir Yassin massacre, where at least 107 Palestinian residents of the village, including women and children, were shot dead. Then the bodies were piled up on top of each other and burned. On April 25th, Haganah forces enter the Jaffa town of Saqqiyah, killing 14 people. An eyewitness says the rest of the villagers left their homes and ran towards the nearest town. He saw two women who couldn't run, so they were shot. On May 22nd, after the residents of Tantura village near Haifa surrendered to the Haganah, between 40 and 200 men were rounded up, shot dead, and buried in a communal grave. Today, that grave has been paved over to build a parking lot.
זוכר כולנו הטבעית וההיסטורית ועל יסוד החלטת עצרת האומות המאוחדות אנו מכריזים בזאת על הקמת מדינה יהודית בארץ ישראל היא מדינת ישראל.
By the time Israel unilaterally declared itself a state on the 14th of May 1948, more than 200 Palestinian villages had been emptied, its people fleeing at gunpoint or in fear from the stories of massacres that happened in towns nearby. By the 15th of May, more than 750,000 Palestinians had been made refugees, never to return to their homes again. The testimonies from those who survived would be passed down from generation to generation, their descendants still holding onto the keys of the homes their grandparents had to flee. The testimonies of the Jewish militants who took part in the massacres that unfolded would take decades to come to light, and when they finally did, it would be hard for Israeli society to stomach. The 15th of May is what Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, the catastrophe. For Israelis, this day is celebrated as their Independence Day. 2 weeks later, David Ben-Gurion, now the first prime minister of the new Jewish state, announced the formation of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, combining the Haganah and the Irgun with the majority of Lehi members joining its ranks. They immediately turned their attention to fighting off the Arab coalition that had responded to Israel's creation and the displacement of Palestinians. The United Nations appointed Foch Bernadotte as the UN mediator in Palestine in an attempt to reach a diplomatic solution to the unfolding Arab-Israeli war. On the 16th of September, he outlined his proposal, a single union between Palestine and Jordan with two sovereign members, one Jewish and one Arab. It would also allow for displaced Palestinians to return to their homes in the now Jewish-controlled cities and villages. In a letter to the UN Secretary General, Bernadette wrote, quote, "It would be an offense against the principles of elemental justice if these innocent victims of the conflict were denied the right to return to their homes, while Jewish immigrants flow into Palestine, and indeed, at least offer the threat of permanent replacement of the Arab refugees who have been rooted in the land for centuries." That letter was published on the 18th of September, 2 days after he had outlined his proposal. But by that time, he was already dead. The day before, while driving through Jerusalem, 4 Lehi operatives ambushed his motorcade and opened fire, killing him and another French military officer. The newly formed Israeli government arrested 200 of Lehi's remaining members and put them on trial for terrorism and disbanding the group. Its leaders, including Yitzhak Shamir, were sentenced to prison, but their sentences would quickly be suspended and they were eventually pardoned. A few years later, Shamir would join a new political party formed by Irgun leader Menachem Begin around the revisionist Zionist ideals of their predecessor, Jabotinsky. It would be called Herut, or Freedom. In a letter published in the New York Times in December 1948, some of the world's most prominent Jewish thinkers, including Albert Einstein and Hannah Arendt, described Menachem Begin and the Irgun as a terrorist right-wing chauvinist organization, and compared the Herut Party in its organization, methods, political philosophy, and social appeal to the Nazi and fascist parties. The Israeli Defense Force would become the foundation of the State of Israel, and its history of terror, assassinations, and ethnic cleansing would be wiped clean. The militant leaders who helped shape its bloody origins would go on to shape the country for decades to come. David Ben-Gurion's message of purity and restraint would become the narrative embedded in the army's propaganda, repeated to the world in response to growing criticism of its tactics. The historical voices who challenged this narrative from inside Israel would be outcast and ridiculed into silence. The Herut Party would remain on the fringes of Israel's parliament for the next two decades, but its ideas would slowly dominate the mainstream. In 1973, Menachem Begin would join forces with a former Haganah commander, Ariel Sharon, and expand Herut into a wider right-wing coalition called Likud. 4 years later, Begin would be elected Israel's prime minister. He'd be succeeded by former Lehi leader Yitzhak Shamir, who would serve as prime minister from 1983 to 1984 and again from 1986 to 1992. By this time, Likud and its revisionist Zionism roots had become an undeniable wing of Israeli politics, as well as its expansionist ambitions. And just 4 years after the end of Shamir's term, Likud would return to office under the stewardship and vision of a young, highly ambitious, and quietly ruthless prime minister. His name was Benjamin Netanyahu.